This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. There's an old adage about children that says the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But what if it does? What if your child is profoundly different from you because they have Down syndrome, autism, dwarfism, or schizophrenia? What if the child's behavior is totally unjustifiable and they become a criminal or a killer? What if the child was conceived in rape and is a reminder of that brutal violation? In his new book, Far From the Tree, our guest Andrew Solomon writes about parents who have accepted their children in spite of what others might consider tragic or even horrifying conditions. Solomon won a National Book Award for The Noonday Demon, his book about depression. He spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Andrew Solomon, welcome back to Fresh Air. So let's start with your research into children conceived in rape. Since rape and abortion became such a major issue in this election, and just to refresh everybody's memories about this, Todd Akin, who ran for the U.S. Senate and was defeated, said, if it's legitimate rape, a woman has a mechanism to shut it down. Richard Murdoch, who was defeated in the Indiana Senate race, said, I think that even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that that is something that God intended to happen. And therefore, he didn't want to make an exception for rape in his stance against abortion. Paul Ryan, who ran for vice president and remains a congressman, said that he thinks abortion should be illegal with no exception for rape because, quote, the method of conception doesn't change the definition of life. Did you hear all these comments through the lens of all the research that you had done on children conceived in rape?
When I set out to write about children conceived in rape, I wanted to strike a very tricky balance, which is that I wanted to describe how some women who have chosen to keep these children have built relationships with them and to explore both the difficulty and the reward that there may be in that. My fear, and I worked very hard to try to ensure this wouldn't happen, was that anything I wrote could be construed to suggest that everyone should keep their child conceived in rape. I don't think everyone should keep their child at all. I think everyone should have free and unfettered access to choice, and that rape is entails more than anything disenfranchising the victim, and the first way to enfranchise someone is to give them a choice. So I wanted to look at what the lives of these women who had kept children were like without ever seeming to suggest they should. But having looked at what those lives were like, I mean, many of the women ultimately were able to build great joy in their relations with their children. Many others weren't. All of them went through agonies. And to hear these people running for office in the United States in the 21st century, effectively dismissing these women's experience and saying that the trauma of carrying such a child was something that was not they didn't deserve legal rights that surrounded it. It was really sickening to me. And Todd Akin's comment was particularly irksome because he said, I believe, that a woman's body has a way of shutting that whole thing down. It reflected such ignorance about human biology. I found those positions brutal and cruel. I know that the people who are very much opposed to abortion feel that abortion contains brutality and cruelty. And my view would be that they therefore have every right to avoid it. But the idea of dictating to women that they can't make that choice, especially under those circumstances, seems to me hideous.
Did the women that you interviewed who carried the children of rape, as opposed to having an abortion, did they think about abortion, or did they make the choice, or did they feel there was no choice for them but to have the baby?
There was some of each. There were definitely some women who felt that there was religious pressure or family pressure that prevented them from having an abortion, or who just had a personal belief that abortion was wrong. But there were a lot of them who wobbled around while they were pregnant. Some of them wobbled around until it was too late to have an abortion, and it's almost as though they didn't quite get around to it. And some of them actually just thought, I'm going to have this child and something beautiful will come out of the awful thing that happened to me. And that could be very powerful. But I mean, the two anecdotes, I think, that for me sum up that chapter. One was a woman who I interviewed who described being really brutally raped, pulled into the backseat of a taxi, raped when she was 16 years old, who had then become pregnant and had to give up the career that she was looking forward to and wasn't able to go to college and so on and so forth. She'd had a very, very traumatic experience. But it was a long time ago. And I said to her, Do you ever think back on the man who raped you? And she said, you know, I used to think of him with a great anger, she said, but now just with pity. And I thought she meant pity because he was so unevolved. And I said, really? And she said, yes, she said, because he has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one. But having said that and having posed that as something in which ultimately, one way or another, this woman has built a life for herself, which has been a very powerful one. I also talk to a lot of women. I mean, there's one woman who said to me, I have to fight against my instincts all the time. Other mothers rely on their instincts, but my instincts are terrifying. And every time she comes over for a hug, it feels like 1,000 razor blades scraping against my skin. And I just think nobody should dictate policy to either of those women. They should each have the option of doing the thing that works for them.
What are some of the issues that the women raised to you about the difficulties or the conflicts that they had carrying a child who was conceived in rape and then mothering the child?
Well, there are several parts to it. One is that we live in an age in which there is a kind of hegemony of genetic determinism. And so all of the women were concerned about the ways in which their child might resemble the rapist psychologically. If the biological father of this child was capable of something so awful, is this child going to turn out to be capable of awful things? So that was one fear. And then next to it, and not entirely separable from it, but also not entirely the same thing, the child was a constant reminder of the rape. As one of the women said to me, I have a friend who was raped, and a few years later, she was really able to get into a kind of useful denial and say it never happened. I will never be able to say it never happened. I will always have that pair of eyes looking at me that are evidence that, yes, it did happen.
So let me just interrupt here with a quote from one of the women who you interviewed. And she's talking about how she was constantly reminded of how her child was conceived. And she says, there were many times that I had terrible feelings of hatred toward my son. The laughter of my little boy often reminded me of the hideous laughter of this guy as he had raped me. I took it out on my son.
Right. I think it's sometimes very difficult not to take it out on your child. I mean, abused children are much more likely to grow up to be abusive parents than other children. And a woman whose child has been conceived in trauma is likely to have a lot more to struggle with than a woman whose child has been conceived in love or at least, you know, proximate affection of some kind. A lot of the women struggled with it. What impressed me was how hard they were trying. I went to Rwanda, actually, because I wanted to see a place where this experience of having a child of rape was commonplace rather than extraordinary. And on my last day there, I had an interview with a woman who, even at the high standards of all of the Tutsi women, was breathtakingly beautiful and incredibly elegant. And we sat in her little hut, and she had actually managed to remarry following the genocide, and her life was in many ways sort of okay. At the end of interviews, I often say to people, do you have any questions for me? Because it helps to rebalance the conversation. So it's not just my taking their story, but I try to give them something as well. And in Rwanda, people would say, will this be published in French? Or are you going to use my real name? Or how long are you here for? Or questions like that. And this woman looked at me, and there was a sort of pause, and she said, you're in this field of psychology, right? And I said, well, yes, more or less. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? She said, because every time I look at her, I think about what happened to me and it gets in the way. Can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And unfortunately, it was only afterwards that I thought how much love there was in that question itself.
Let's talk about the research that you did about families in which a child is born with Down syndrome. First, I'm going to ask you to describe the condition.
The scientific name for Down syndrome is trisomy 21, and the condition is characterized by having an extra copy of the 21st chromosome, and it's the most common genetic anomaly that there is. It affects a large number of people. It's also one of the first things for which it was possible to scan prenatally using amniocentesis, And many women who discover that they are carrying a pregnancy with a child who will develop or will be affected by Down syndrome choose to terminate those pregnancies. There's a very broad range of function in people with Down syndrome, as there is, in fact, in people without Down syndrome. But it's striking that some people seem to have it more than others. But most of them are intellectually disadvantaged, some of them severely disadvantaged. They have faces that look a little bit different. They have very round faces, and their eyes tend to be on something of a slant. They don't have a lot of abilities in areas of thought and argument, such as logic. Some of them have additional physical disabilities. It can be a very severe syndrome. It's also the one in which medical science, or rather social science, has made the most radical advances in recent years with changes in how people are treated.
If you're a parent of a child with Down syndrome, you have to alter your life for the rest of your life in a very profound way. And if you could talk a little bit about how parents felt that their lives had been changed for better or for worse by the things they had to give up and the things that they received in return.
You know, there's a famous passage, I don't know what else to call it, but a passage, a sort of little, almost a prose poem by Emily Pearl Kingsley, who was a writer for Sesame Street, who has a son with Down syndrome, and whose son has done remarkably for someone affected by DS. And she wrote something called Welcome to Holland. I always feel a little bit bad for the Dutch in relation to this particular thing, but it basically describes the process of having a child with disabilities as being like getting on a plane to Italy and then discovering that you're landing in Holland, and you'll always miss Italy and you'll always wish you'd seen the things of Italy, but if you spent your whole time worrying about that, you won't notice the beauty of Holland and the tulips and the Rembrandts and so on. And it's a kind of lovely metaphoric passage, and it's helped vast numbers of people, and many, many people I met described having been deeply moved by it. What I found is that, again, the sort of time of diagnosis and the time of birth was often very difficult and upsetting for people. Kids with Down syndrome are, by and large, quite affectionate and relatively guileless, and frequently the attachments to them grow and deepen. And the meaning that parents find in it grows and deepens. So the story that epitomizes it perhaps was of Tom and Karen Robards, who are a couple I met in New York, who had gotten involved in changing the way education services are delivered to people with Down syndrome. They set up something called the Cook Center, and they did really noble and heroic work in that arena. And their son is now 30. And I said, look, this is, you've given your lives to this. I said, do you wish you hadn't? Do you wish you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish you could make it go away? And his mother said, you know, for our son, David, I wish I could make it go away, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I would do anything to make David's life easier. She said, but speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 30 years ago that I would get to such a point. Speaking for myself, it's made me think so much more deeply and appreciate humanity so much more broadly and live so much more richly that speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world. And while she articulated that idea with particular eloquence, I found that it was a not infrequent refrain, that most of the parents had become very attached to their children. And at some level, I kept thinking, but surely you'd rather have children without Down syndrome. And then I thought, people become attached to their children with whatever their flaws are. I'm attached to my children with whatever flaws they have. And if some glorious angel broke through the living room ceiling and offered to exchange them for other better children, I'd cling to my kids and pray away this specter. We all love flawed children, and the general assumption that these more extreme flaws make the children somehow unlovable, it wasn't true to most of my experience.
So one of your chapters is on children who become criminals, and two of the people who you interviewed for that chapter were the parents of Dylan Klebold. And Klebold, along with Eric Harris, killed 13 people, 12 students and one teacher, at Columbine High School in Colorado in April of 1999. Why did you want to talk with them?
You know, I really wanted to understand what it was like to have a child who had done something so awful and what effect it had on the emotional life and the experience of the parents. I had found, as I did research on crime in general, and I had taken a job for a few months working on a theater project in a juvenile facility in Minnesota, I had found that mostly, contrary to popular perception, the parents of criminals are not themselves criminals. Mostly, the parents of criminals don't think it's such a great idea to commit crimes. Mostly, especially with juvenile felons, the parents are very distressed and want to fix the situation. And I was interested in trying to understand what the dynamics of that were. And then when I had the opportunity to talk to the Klebolds, I thought, how could you ever recover from having a child who had done something as horrific as what Dylan Klebold did? And I also, I think, was still trying to figure out, okay, but do the parents cause these things to happen? And I thought, maybe if I understand these parents, then I'll understand why the Columbine Massacre occurred. And I was curious. And I would say what I feel now that I've spent all that time with them is that knowing the parents has made it far more mysterious to me than it was before I met them.
Did the Klebolds have any idea how troubled their son was and what he was capable of?
You know, it took a long time for me to persuade them that that we could talk about all of this. And then when they finally agreed to it, they were so full of their story, it overflowed in them. And at the end of the first long weekend that I spent recording, I think more than 20 hours of interviews over a weekend, we were sitting, all of us very exhausted, around the kitchen table. And I said, if Dylan were here now, is there anything you'd want to ask him or tell him, or do you have a question for him? And his father said, I sure would. I'd ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother, Sue, sort of looked down at the floor, and she thought, and then she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. I think she had no idea. I think now that I've got to know both parents well, if they had had any idea, they would have done something. They would have fixed it. They would have intervened. I think people can keep their character very secret. And having had the experience with Tom and Sue, I look even at my own children and think, I think I know them well, but I have to always remember that you never necessarily do. But I'm sure, 100% sure, that his parents had no idea he was planning such a thing. They just, if they had had any idea, they would have tried to stop it. That's who they are.
So I'm going to ask an outsider's question, which is, how could you not know that your son was so troubled?
So I think that we have a long history of thinking that things are caused by parents. We thought that autism was caused by parents. Refrigerator mothers were the ones who caused it. Schizophrenia was apparently something that you developed because your parents had an unconscious wish that you not exist. If you go back 100 years further, there was the idea of imaginationism, which said that the reason that your child was a dwarf or had deformities was because the mother had lascivious longings which were expressed in the deformities of her child. These theories of implicating parents go back all the way through history, and a lot of them have now been dismissed. But crime is the one area in which people seem not to be able to let go of that idea. I saw endless family photos. I saw a video that Tom had made of Dylan 3 days before the massacre when he was going off to the prom. And he looks like a feckless adolescent who's a little bit irritable. He looks like all the other feckless adolescents who are a little bit irritable whom one comes across. And I think that he was someone who had that ability, which is a profound ability, to hide his true nature from other people. In the same way that I think, I don't know, it would appear that Jerry Sandusky for a long time could hide his nature from a lot of other people who were quite close around him. People have that skill and that ability, and it comes in unpredictable ways and places. And I think he presented a very, very convincing facade. And I think that convincing facade was actually a large part of who he was, but I think he expressed it as all of who he was and kept this other part held away in secret.
I want to quote something. There's a couple of things that Dylan Klebold's mother said to you. And I guess this was upon hearing the news of what was going on at Columbine. She said, "While every mother in town was praying that her child was safe, I had to pray that mine would die before he hurt anyone else." And then she said to you that she She had hoped that he would die by suicide rather than going to into the criminal justice system where he might be executed. And she said, "I gave the hardest prayer I ever made that he would kill himself, because then at least I would know that he wanted to die and wouldn't be left with all the questions I'd have if he got caught by a police bullet. I've spent so many hours regretting that prayer. I wished for my son to kill himself, and he did."
Right. It's a very powerful statement. If you read, as I now have, the thousands and thousands of pages of material relevant to the various lawsuits that were brought in connection with Columbine, you can read a lot of Dylan's writings and a lot of Eric Harris's writings. And what you find if you do so is that Dylan was mostly depressed, and it feels as though he went along with the brutality of killing other people in part because that was Eric's big idea. And Eric was mostly out to rule and then destroy the world. And he went along with killing himself because it was Dylan's idea. But Dylan definitely was suicidal. Now, it should be said that Dylan had had a minor criminal offense a year before Columbine, had been in trouble with the police, had then been assessed by a psychiatrist who saw no evidence that he was troubled in any way, no evidence that he was depressed, certainly no evidence that he was psychopathic. Nobody saw it. But the thing that Sue said about that was that she just, when she heard the reports and understood what was happening, she said it was so awful, but she was in a state of such agony about what was happening to her child, but also what was happening to all of these other children. She's a very empathetic person, and I think the idea that she was somehow implicated in this wanton horror that was taking place was awful. And I think even aside from the question of whether she was implicated, simply the fact that it was happening was so immensely distressing to her. And like everyone in Colorado then, maybe everyone in the country who had the news on, you know, everyone thought, oh my God, when is this going to stop? And she had that tragic knowledge that it was only going to stop when her son was dead.
Writing this book seems to have had a profound effect on you, including becoming part of the reason why your personal story has changed. While writing this book, you got married, and you and your husband have a son. You both are also sperm donors. And I think part of the reason why you became enthusiastic about being a father had to do with all these families that you wrote about.
I had always hoped that I would someday have children, but I'd never known quite when or whether, and I certainly didn't know how. And I met John, who's now my husband, at almost exactly the same time that I sold the proposal for this book back in 2001. And he then told me that he had been the donor for some lesbian friends and that they had a son of whom he was the biological father, Oliver, who was supposed to call him Donor Dad, but because he couldn't quite understand the word, kept calling him Donut Dad instead. And then a couple of years later, Tammy and Laura asked him to be a donor again, and they had a daughter, Lucy. And then one of my best friends from college had gone through a difficult divorce, and she and I were talking about it, and I said, "Are you sad about it?" And she said, "No," she said, "the only thing I'm sad about is not being a mother." And I said rather lightly, because I didn't think it was something she would be particularly inclined toward, but I said, "Well, if you ever decide you want a baby, I would love to be the father." And she said a few years later, "I've really thought about it." She said, "What do you think?" And we realized that was something we both really wanted to do. So I have a daughter who lives with her mother in the Southwest but comes up to visit, and we go to visit there all the time. We were there a few days ago. And I have then John and I talked about it, and I really wanted us to have the experience of being full-time parents. So we decided to have another child. We had George. We found an egg donor, Laura, who was the one within the Tammy and Laura couple who had been the biological mother of Oliver and Lucy, said to John, "I'll never be able to thank you enough for allowing us to have a family and helping us with that, but I could show you how much you mean to us by carrying this child for you." And so we've ended up in this sort of funny amalgam of five parents of four children in three states, and we all sort of fit together in our way. And people said to me, "But you were doing this book about all of these terrible things that have gone wrong for all of these families, and surely doing that would have made you draw back from the project of having your own family. And I said that on the contrary, I felt that what the book was about was the fact that parents can love almost anyone who is presented to them as their child, and that that love has a compelling urgency to it that rises above any difficulty. And I thought, whoever my children turn out to be, I think I'll be able to love them. And I felt that partly because of what I'd seen in these other families, and partly also because I had been somewhat unforgiving of my family for being a little slow, not very slow, but a little slow to accept the fact that I was gay. And when I started looking at all of these families, I thought, loving someone and accepting someone are two different things. And I thought, my parents always loved me. It just took them a while to accept me, and then they got there. And actually, all of these parents had to struggle to accept their children, and then they got there. And I began to think, all parents at some level have to struggle to accept their children. Their children are always full of surprises. And I thought, okay, I don't know, the acceptance thing may be tricky, but I'll bet I'll get through it, and I'll bet that I'll be able to love them, whoever they are.
Well, your thoughts about becoming a parent were pretty much tested right at birth when your son George was born and there was a period you thought he might have a profound disability. Describe what happened.
So George was born. We were all in the delivery room, Laura, who was carrying the pregnancy, and John and I. And when he was born, they noticed that there had been a knot in his umbilical cord. And they said they thought everything was fine, but if the knot had tightened, that it could have cut off oxygen to his brain. And then we went off and we went to sleep and everything seemed fine. And the next day, John said, oh, the pediatrician wants to talk to you. And I assumed it was the routine conversation of the first day in his life. And the pediatrician said, he's not extending his legs in the way that he should. And I said, oh. And she said, yes, she said, and insofar as he is extending them, he's doing so somewhat asymmetrically. And I said, is that a cause for concern? And she said, well, she said, the fact that he's not extending them may indicate significant brain damage. She said, the fact that he's not extending them symmetrically may mean there's asymmetric brain damage, possibly a tumor. And John, who hadn't been writing this book, said, oh, I'm sure he's going to be fine, and essentially has a more optimistic temperament than I do anyway. But I had witnessed what all these families had been through, and I knew that you often find out in the first few days of a child's life that you're on a completely different course than you thought you were. And I was terrified by it. And I suddenly realized when I looked at George, I had been thinking, I have this baby. Do I love this baby? And then I suddenly found myself trying not to love this baby. I thought, what if this baby is going to be incredibly sick and die? And I wanted to stop being emotionally engaged. And I realized I couldn't do that. And we then had an endless thing of scans and all kinds of things. And after about 5 hours, they said, well, the scans are all clear. And look, now he's extending his legs just the way he should. He probably had a cramp earlier. And I thought you might have mentioned that that was a possibility when you were telling me about brain tumors. But I kept thinking how ironic it would be if in the middle of writing this book, I had a child who had some kind of severe disability. But nature is no stranger to ironies, and it could have happened. I definitely experienced it differently than I would have before I'd written this book, because I think before I'd written the book, it would have seemed to me like not only like a tragedy for the child, but I would have thought, I don't want to have this life at all. And now I looked at it and I thought, oh, God, I hope this child isn't going to suffer. And I thought, I really hope I'm not going to suffer. I don't especially want to do this. But I thought, if it's what I have to do, I know I can. I'd learned that from these other parents.
Andrew Solomon's new book is called Far From the Tree. You'll find a much longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Legal marijuana for recreational use? Who ever thought we'd see that happen? But this past election day, voters in Colorado and the state of Washington passed ballot initiatives to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana. Journalist Tony DeCopel has been writing about the changing legal status, business, and culture of marijuana. He wrote Newsweek's recent cover story called The New Pot Barons about how entrepreneurs have been preparing for marijuana's legalization. DeCopel is also writing a book about marijuana that's part history and part memoir about his father, who was a major marijuana smuggler in the 70s and 80s. Tony DeCopel spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Tony DeCopil, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's just start with an overview of what changed legally during this election regarding marijuana.
Well, it's been a profound change. In two states, marijuana has not only been legalized for personal consumption and possession, but over the next year, we'll see the creation of a regulated retail model, which is something that doesn't exist anywhere in the world. That process is going to be contentious. It's going to be fascinating to watch. And if it's not interrupted by the government, it's going to be historic. By the federal government, I mean.
Well, what's very confusing about this, and I think everybody's confused about this, is that Colorado and in the state of Washington, it's legal now to sell and buy marijuana for recreational use. But marijuana is still a controlled substance under the federal law. So the federal law and these two state laws are at odds. So what does the Justice Department plan on doing? Have they said anything about that yet?
The Justice Department hasn't said anything about other than that they're reviewing the situation. There's speculation that a federal injunction will be issued preventing the legislatures in each of these states, Colorado and Washington State, from moving forward with what the voters have asked for until it's sorted out legally. And that's what everyone expects.
Colorado already has a for-profit marijuana market. Can you describe what that market is like now?
Colorado is an amazing state because it has the industrialized world's only regulated for-profit cannabis market of any kind. You know, it happens to be medical, but it's going to be the basis for the legal market as well. It's an amazing system. It was created by this career lawman named Matt Cook, who was director of enforcement at the state level. And he constructed this regulatory system using a little bit from used car sales laws and a little bit from casinos and a little bit from gambling. And it's extremely tight. He says he can regulate anything. And so what you have there is commercial grows, you know, more than a million square feet of warehouse space outside of Denver, dedicated to growing marijuana, and then you have hundreds of dispensaries dedicated to selling it. And the marijuana grown there is tracked from the time it's put into not the ground because they're growing it indoors, but when the time it blooms to final sale, every single ounce is accounted for. It's an incredible system, and you know, legalization will likely borrow from it heavily in the next year or so.
You toured several pot warehouses. Would you describe the rooms in which the marijuana plants are grown?
Absolutely. I hope that in the future there are tours of marijuana warehouses in the same way that there are tours of breweries today, because it's really incredible. By law, you have to grow indoors in Colorado. And to do that, these rooms are rigged with lights that mimic the effects of sunlight to grow the plant. And you know, different rooms have different seasons in them, and there's a perpetual grow, and different plants require different kinds of sunlight. So you walk into these warehouses, and at first you don't see anything because the actual plants are in smaller rooms within rooms, and all you hear is like the buzz of electricity. It's damp. You know, you expect a forklift to come in from a side door, and then you get a little bit deeper in, and you open one of these doors, which are about the size of like Winnebago's, where the actual plants are, and your eyes just recognize, oh my God, summer sunshine. It's like you want lemonade. And then you see a field of plants waving gently because they're stirred by fans, and there'll be classical music playing or there'll be hard rock depending on what the grower says the plant likes. And then you'll go to another room and you open the door and it'll have like a honey-coated light and you'll be like, oh, fall, I want a pumpkin latte. How beautiful. And then there'll be workers in there too, and the workers, they're like the Keebler elves of cannabis. They live among the plants. They sleep there. They're caring for the plants constantly. They're deeply, devoutly about the plant, and they're usually shirtless. They're walking around barefoot, and it's like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, except for cannabis. Like they're these people who are so committed and so interesting and so unlike who you would see at like the Coca-Cola factory, that it's just a phenomenal experience. It's a feast for all, you know, all the senses.
So this legal marijuana is grown with such kind of care and love under such controlled circumstances indoors. Compare that to the product that comes in, say, illegally from Mexico.
It's not comparable. Mexico historically grew its marijuana, you know, in these hilly in ravines, growing out with a mule piss and like whatever fertilizer they could find. It was like it wasn't grown in ideal circumstances. No one cared about the quality in the 60s and 70s. People weren't educated about marijuana to the extent they are today. So traditionally, Mexican marijuana is grown outdoors and sold to, you know, the gringos who will smoke anything. It's been transported illegally, so it's crushed in transit. In the old days, at least, it used to smell like gasoline or like seawater or whatever, however it was brought into the country. And it was not attractive to look at. You can look at High Times magazine, sort of the Playboy of pot from the 70s, and the centerfolds, which, you know, are women in Playboy but are marijuana buds in High Times. This is true. It's not an attractive thing. It looks like something you chewed at dinner and then put on the corner of your plate. It's like a root vegetable, like broccoli you couldn't digest. That's what the marijuana used to look like. And now it's like it's a perfect furry little acorn, like a green corn on the cob, which is fur and then you hold it up to the light and the crystals shine. It's like a little chandelier. It's nothing like what you used to see.
And Colorado passed a bill to create a framework for controlling the industry, a sales framework.
That's right. A very stringent sales framework. So in Colorado, the medical marijuana growers have to have 24-hour video of their operations. And that video is accessible by the state at any time. They can tap into it. And they all have these badges. And they had to go through background checks to get these badges. So there's an attempt to keep black market money out of it. So in Colorado, you're not going to see a situation, or you're unlikely to see a situation where, you know, a dispensary is in fact just a front for a Mexican cartel. And then they have this additional rule, which is pretty revolutionary, where there's it's called the 70-30 rule, where 70% of all the marijuana that each store sells, they have to grow themselves. So that goes a long way to eliminating the introduction of black market weed. So stores aren't just buying all of their weed from Mexican cartels and then marking it up. And that's a huge reason why the feds have focused on California. California doesn't have tight regulations on who grows marijuana, where it comes from. So the feds move in, and what they claim is that, you know, these are fronts. These businesses, these medical marijuana businesses, are fronts for what in fact just old school black market drug dealers. And they're not growing medical marijuana in small batches for patients. They're growing it in Mexico, or they're growing it in the hills, and they're just bringing it in, and it suddenly magically becomes legal once it gets in the store. But in fact, it's based on illegality. Colorado doesn't have that.
So getting back to Colorado, in Colorado there's a licensing fee that's like thousands of dollars. And who needs a license? What is the license?
Right. So if you want to grow or sell medical marijuana in Colorado, you need a license. And the licensing process is this really stringent process that includes the background check I just talked about. And it's very pricey. So if you're like just a hippie spiritualist, unfortunately, and this is controversial, you may struggle to survive, to have the capital to survive in the current medical marijuana business in Colorado.
So is it very controversial whether the business guys or the hippie guys should have a right to the business?
Well, yeah, because there are people who believe that marijuana is God's plant and the government doesn't have any business regulating it. People have no business selling it, making a profit off of it. This is medicine. It's obscene to try to profit off of it. I mean, that is a significant subculture within the wider marijuana culture. The other background that's important is because of federal prohibition, the medical marijuana industry is not an industry that has traditional bank loans. You can't walk into Bank of America and say, I have a small business. I'd like $1 million and here's my projections. And, you know, you can't even – because the banks are afraid that they're going to be complicit in a crime if they give you money. So that creates a kind of elite, especially in Colorado. You have to have access to private capital. That means you either have rich family or rich friends or, you know, some other creative means of getting cash, because you're not getting it through traditional channels.
So, you know, if you're in business, there's a lot of, you know, like business tax deductions that you can claim. And that's, you know, that's always very helpful if you're in business. But, you know, in terms of like IRS tax deductions, you know, growing and selling marijuana is still illegal with federal law. It's a controlled substance. So you can't, I assume you can't, you know, deduct your business expenses in your federal returns.
Sort of. You kind of can, right? This is a very, very interesting contradiction that the federal government has. So while the Justice Department raids medical marijuana dispensaries and threatens others, the IRS is happy to accept taxes on the millions of dollars in sales that they generate. And the taxes that the IRS takes are huge, much bigger than the average business because they do not allow deductions related to the sale to employees, to health insurance, to the sale of the marijuana. Confusingly, they do allow you to deduct the cost of growing the plant. So the result of that, well, there are two readings on that. You know, one reading is, hey, that's a conscious decision. Clearly the government is, somebody in the government is in our corner because if all deductions were removed, which could happen. I mean, there's no reason why it hasn't happened except for this approval. If all deductions were removed, no medical marijuana industry or business or marijuana at large business could survive without IRS deductions. So some people see it as a wink-wink from the government.
When you were in Colorado reporting on the medical marijuana legal market, what are some of the forms that you found marijuana being marketed in?
Marijuana isn't anything you want. I mean, it comes in the original plant product, vegetable product, and it comes in hot dogs. I recently toured a marijuana products company, the biggest in Colorado. It's called Dixie Elixirs, and it's soon to be the biggest nationally because it has a distribution network in place. And they make fizzy sodas with THC. And a lot of THC, 120 milligrams, which, you know, a joint has 5 milligrams. So we're talking about a serious dosage. They also make truffles, and they also sell more medicinal-looking items like pills and this, like, a droplet of THC that you put beneath your tongue as, like, a berry flavor, very medicinal. But, yeah, marijuana is in everything. It can be put in anything.
You wrote an article about the case against legalization. Would you explain some of the main points in that case?
Yes, I will talk about the case against legalization, although I do so warily, knowing that I could be getting emails right this second from people angry at me for bringing up any of the downsides. You know, the push to legalize marijuana is a political campaign, and you don't win political campaigns by saying maybe, could be a good idea, possibly. You know, so a lot of the claims are fantastic. They're the outer edge of truth or a way past truth. And, you know, a couple of them, for example, some people say that legalizing marijuana is going to put the Mexican cartels out of business. Well, no. The cartels are diversified. Some people say that everyone who wants marijuana already has it, so we're not going to see any change. You know, legalization will just mean cops have more time and people won't be going to jail. But that's not true. Prohibition does have an effect. The fact that marijuana is illegal today means, you know, approximately a third fewer people use it. And additionally, the marijuana that's on the market is weaker, because it's generally the Mexican stuff. And so the case against legalization is, look, we want to discourage the use of this. We don't want our markets flooded with cheap, strong weed, and we don't want to be on the road to the creation of a vice industry. And by the way, you know, if we do legalize, all these supposed benefits, like huge tax revenue or reduction in violence, those are not guaranteed. They're not guaranteed at all.
You have a personal connection to this story about marijuana, which is that your father was a marijuana smuggler in the 70s and 80s. Did you know that when you were growing up?
I didn't know that. I did not know what my father's occupation was. I didn't find it out until I was in my teens. And in my teens, my understanding of it was just that my parents were hippies and they sold a little marijuana. And then a few years ago, I wrote a Newsweek story in which I actually investigated my father's connection to the drug business, and I got his federal records. And surprise, surprise, he was arrested in the early 90s on a job selling 17 tons of marijuana, which was enough at the time to roll a joint for every college-aged kid in America. So in retrospect, and I've learned that he had no other occupation for 20 years other than marijuana smuggler and dealer, starting small and growing to multi-ton shipments for years. And marijuana taught me to read because marijuana paid for my private school. It bought my baseball gloves. It put presents under the tree at Christmas. So I'm very much a product of marijuana.
How has your father's storied career as a major marijuana smuggler in the 70s and 80s influenced your work as a journalist covering marijuana and now all the new legal issues surrounding it?
It's hard to say. I don't think that my background... I can imagine someone being like, he's only mentioning the downsides of legalization because he's angry at his dad. And I don't think that's the case at all. I'm still in touch with my dad. He comes to see the grandkids. He and I are fine. So I hope that doesn't come across. I think it certainly helps me in covering this issue, the fact that I have a family connection to it, and that as soon as legalization passed, I got text messages from my mother and from my father's friends saying, like, we're going to Colorado, yay, exclamation point. all that definitely helps me in covering this journalistically because I have instant credibility with people who are in the business. And in fact, I'm never shy about mentioning my family connection to sources because they understand immediately that, I have a long view perspective of this. I'm not somebody who covers the region and is now dropping in on this issue. I'm someone who knows the issue.
Tony DeCopel has been writing about changing marijuana law, business, and culture for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. You'll find links to several of his articles, as well as a much longer version of DeCopel's conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Excuse me while I light my spirit. Oh God, I got to take a lift. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.